Hey there, Freedom Fighters. My name is Andrew Warner, the founder of Mixergy, where I interview entrepreneurs about how they built their businesses. And joining me is an entrepreneur that I think I might have scared off a little bit. I nearly might have scared you off, Dan. You tell me.
Yeah, maybe a bit. I was up for a challenge, yeah.
Dan Avias is the founder of Current Media. It's a reward-based streaming ecosystem that rewards users for attention and data while consuming content. The reason that I feel like I might have scared him off for a bit was he's got a cryptocurrency. And I found that anytime an entrepreneur has anything to do with cryptocurrency, it either goes over my head or there's something weird going on that hurts my reputation to even be involved with. And so I've been really scared. And I told him, look, I'll just be open with you about my skepticism around crypto, around ICO, around paying users or rewarding them in any way for doing something online. And Dan said, well, I think you just didn't know, is Andrew going to just be a jerk and leading me into something where all he's going to do is beat me up for an hour? Is this just a weird way to say hi? And I think it's me being open.
Well, I appreciate your honesty, and I agree with you with a lot of things within crypto that are, there's a lot of negative stuff within the industry. We have a little bit different of a story, and I'm happy to share some insights on that because we have been able to make change some people's opinions about not only us but the industry as a whole.
All right. I'm coming at this open-minded. I should say this interview is sponsored by two phenomenal sponsors. The first, if you need a website hosted, I'm going to tell you later why you should sign up for HostGator. And the second, if you need a developer, and man, they're big on crypto too, in addition to other technologies, TopTal will get you covered. Now, I'll talk about those later. Dan, I feel like what happened was you saw what I saw and many other people saw, which was cryptocurrency was going huge and there had to be something in it. And you got in and you didn't make a quick buck and you didn't give up on it when the rest of the world moved on. And here you are somehow connected to cryptocurrency, even though it's tangentially related to your business. Am I right?
To some degrees, let me touch on that. So I have been involved in cryptocurrency quite early on into it. I actually got involved with it just as investing in Bitcoin soon after college.
What year was this?
2015, probably 2014.
Okay. And how did it do for you?
It did very well. Bitcoin was not worth all that much back then. It's not like I didn't buy like a truckload of it, but bought enough to do fine on it. So I kind of just held it. But never thought that I would personally, maybe launch a company within it. I like the general idea around it. I found out about it because of a kid that went to MIT that was mining Bitcoin. And I thought at the time, he literally meant he was mining like in a mine. And
So how was he mining crypto, Bitcoin specifically?
He said that he was just doing it in his dorm room or something. I didn't know that well. It was a story that I was brought up at a random party I went to that was a friend of my ex-girlfriend's brother. And it was a very strange thing. And I was like, then I looked into it, thought it was really interesting. And, that's how I kind of got involved in it. But, then say like blacked out on it for two years, like 3 years, just kind of like had it behind my head. What ended up happening is, I then go on this trip to Israel actually, with a bunch of entrepreneurs, met this really, amazing entrepreneur who had exited, been working in different gaming companies and stuff. And she told me at the time that she was launching a cryptocurrency. And it was really the first time I had heard about it. And this is a year before kind of maybe a year and a half before this period that you're kind of talking about where like I was literally sitting in Thanksgiving and everyone is talking about crypto. So it's before that whole rush. And, that's when I got like more interested in it. And it was very timely because within our business, maybe 6 months later, we were kind of, we had developed this music platform. And we were kind of thinking about a way to better reward our users. And then this whole concept of like, well, what if we rewarded people for their attention while they were using our service? And we thought about, what are ways that we can do this? And then one of the ideas was to do potentially our own cryptocurrency, but we didn't really solidify that concept. We kind of, tossed it around. And then comes 5 or 6 months later, the same person that I talked with maybe a year before does launch that cryptocurrency in ICO. Okay. At the time, it was the largest ICO that had ran. And then I was like, wow, like this this is possible. Like, look at this crazy industry that's happening and all this other stuff. And so then we, you know, looked at it again, like as I was like, well, what if we change the dynamic of rewarding, you know, based on point stuff? And then we started focusing on launching this crypto. And then what this crypto really values is what this people's attention are. So then, you know, that's what we, you know, decided to do. We went through a whole process deciding is like, do we want to go a traditional venture out or do we do this? And that seemed much more exciting. And, you know, it was in line.
Because you thought we'd raise money through crypto. I know someone who raised the most money ever through crypto by having an ICO. And then you said we could reward our listeners who are listening to our music app by giving them some cryptocurrency. That's the original incarnation. Am I right?
Yeah, it was a thing that at the time, what we felt that there had not really been anyone in the space that were focused on our type of user, right? And so every music streaming platform really has focused on one thing, and not just music streaming, just streaming in general, and media, which is offer a free service and then charge, right? And we were like, we don't need to even do that. Like, let's focus on just free users, and we reward people based that actually have more time on their hands than money per se. And that is what we're really rewarding here. And it was very tied to like the whole UBDI model, like universal basic income and rewarding data. And it's also timely with what's kind of happening with Facebook and data privacy, GDPR.
California. I mean, if they're giving up their privacy, they should get something in return other than seeing their sister's photos. They should get something of value.
Right. And okay. So all that policy stuff is coming at the same time. So it was all these things kind of aligning, because, you know, I had never really even heard about, you know, a lot of these things maybe a year before. But, you know, obviously data privacy and this whole attention side of things and the attention economy is becoming much more relevant. And so those stars kind of aligned, and we went through it a lot. And there was a lot within our company to decide if that was the path that we would take, because we did have like a kind of a limited amount of runway to really make a decision on if that's the path that we want to take.
And then what about music?
Yeah.
Do you now have the major music publishers? Do you have, your music library now?
Yeah. So the way we actually operate is very similar to say TuneIn Radio. Do we aggregate a variety of different stations from around the world, about 100,000 of them. And so users can listen to the music from those stations.
Radio stations.
Yeah, they're internet.
Got it. So you're pulling in radio stations the way the TuneIn does, and the ads don't interrupt the stations, do they? They come on in the app.
Yeah, some stations, if we decide to feature them, they have their own ads in there. We try and source stations that obviously are a good experience for our users. But a lot of the revenue, as of right now, we don't make money on audio ads. That passes through to the stations, who pay the statutory rate based off of internet radio.
Got it.
Does allow us to do some pretty unique stuff, at least in some markets. Something that TuneIn, for example, also does is allow users to record the radio streams for their own private use, which actually still abides within the Fair Use Act. And so that's something that we also offer our users for free, so they can have a legal and free streaming service that also has capability to be offline. They just can't pull the music out of the app.
Okay, I got it. And so it makes sense. And one of the ways that you said that you get people's attention so that you could display ads is on Android, you take over the lock screen, right?
Yes.
And then is it only when the music's playing or always?
No, it's always. And right, it's something they can do. We're rolling out a feature that allows them to snooze that functionality, so that it doesn't, like if they're in a meeting or something like that, or they don't want to. But underlyingly, what happens there is like the lock screen music player lives on that screen. And Android is our primary market. It's 90% of our user base.
Ah, okay.
It's very interesting to see, especially when you're kind of like culminating the concept of data and attention. Because what we see is, you know, our users on average open their phone north of 50 times a day. So each time that happens, you know, you're rendering impressions. The first thing they see is our product.
Got it. And your product is the ability to let them play music again, but also lets them see an ad. And then if they interact with the ad, the example you gave me before we got started was if they sign up for Hulu because of one of your ads, they get points that they could use to get gift cards and other benefits. And you now get the revenue that Hulu pays you for a new customer, right?
Yeah, if they see an affiliate-based ad, there's also just display-based advertising. And there's a lot of first-party data that we're collecting to, you know, have more targeted conversions for our advertiser base. But in general, like, you know, that's a very, it's a very interesting advertising unit within the product itself. Okay. But so that's essentially how we're able to generate, a good bit of revenue, within the product itself. Like, we actually don't make a lot of money on the music streaming, as you can imagine. It's actually, music streaming is a very tough business, to be in. The reason that we focused on it directly was, we knew that, the concept of play music, get paid, is something that people generally like. And it gets them in the door. We monetize through a variety of other behaviors that happen within the product itself.
What else?
There's a lot of market research companies that we work with, for example.
For surveys.
For surveys and things of that nature. That's one capability. Another one is like the affiliate offers that I had mentioned, where if like a user interacts with a specific offer, they get a certain amount of points. We also are doing things now. This hasn't launched fully yet, but it's in the process. We have gotten approved from the major credit card companies, Visa, MasterCard, American Express, so that users can essentially enroll their credit card or debit card within our service. And then if you shop at like a store, whether it's like a Walmart or Starbucks, whatever is running an offer at the time, you get additional cash back for shopping at that store in the form of points within our product. So we're really monetizing a variety of the behaviors that people have, in addition to kind of the data that they share with our service.
What happened to crypto? You guys were going to give cryptocurrency, as you said earlier. Why couldn't you give them crypto in exchange for listening to music?
Yeah, so fundamentally, after we decided to go down that path of going down the token sale route, it was in this very interesting moment of kind of like where the industry was. You had a ton of these ICOs kind of coming out, and then they were sharing this concept of what is a utility token, right? And a lot of companies were basically saying like, oh, it's a utility token, it's not a security. We basically raised our capital right at the brink of that whole concept. And then maybe a month after, or maybe a couple weeks after, the SEC was like, hey, these things are likely restricted securities. And so we had to kind of go down that path of like, we basically went to the best attorneys that we could possibly find, and basically told them everything, that kind of how we did our offering. And then they basically said, listen, in order for this to be a compliant offering, you're going to have to offer basically a repurchase rescission to every investor. And
Let me take a moment here for a second. So I guess I should say ICO, initial coin offering. The idea is you create new cryptocurrency, this new set of coins. People pay you for the initial versions coins. Yeah. You then have all this money that you can run your business with. As you were mentioning earlier, there's a difference between a utility and a security. Tell me if I'm understanding this part right. If people are buying the coins in order to get something out of the service, that's one thing. But if they're buying it in order to fund the company, that's basically like selling shares, and the SEC wants you to follow their rules for selling shares. I know I'm oversimplifying. Am I on the right track?
It's basically, there's a thing called the Howey test, which is a kind of a guideline. Like, basically it was this whole thing like around oranges in like the 1930s or something, where it's like, anything can be a security. And so if there is an expectation for profit on whatever you're buying, then it will likely be defined as a security. And therefore, you need to follow underlying security laws, which means in the United States, the investors need to be accredited. You have to follow a 1-year restriction period for them to be able to be sold to unaccredited. There's a variety of rules, right? And so when a lot of these companies are saying like, oh no, we're a utility, we don't have to follow these things. But, and there is actually a point though that a security can be a utility and turn into one. There's just not really any guidance that the SEC has given as to when that happens. So as an example, Ethereum, which is the second major cryptocurrency behind Bitcoin, they did an ICO, a few years ago. And when they did their ICO, that was viewed as a security. But over time, the network became decentralized enough, and it's no longer viewed as a security by the SEC. And the SEC has stated that, actually. But there's no guidance of when that occurs, right? So there's a lot of like kind of a gray area in the space, but that has done notoriously well for those people that were in the initial Ethereum ICO, even at the price that Ethereum is at today. It's an incredible return. So that's essentially why or how it could work on to become a utility per se.
Meanwhile, you started selling coins just as they told you this is not really the right way to do it. You then gave back money to people who paid you. Am I right? Will you take it from there? What happened?
So basically, we went then through a formal process of how any company would do where they feel like the offering was not to the standards that you would need to, right? And most companies now, when you mind about ICOs, it's actually because the SEC stepping in says, like, you need to offer rescission to the investors of this, right? And so that happened in the cases of several different tokens. We had done that proactively without anyone saying that based off of like what our lawyers had said. So then we went through this whole process, created new documentation, and then sent that out to our investor base. And basically people had the option of, you know, either getting a refund or staying in the deal and then re-signing updated documents that showed like, hey, this is a security. Here's all the disclosures and all that stuff. And it was like a massive PPM with all that information. So that's what we went through with that process.
All right, let's go back and understand how you got here. But, you know, first, I'm going to tell everyone, my first sponsor is TopTal. It's a place where you can go hire developers. One of the things that they told me is that they have, like when a technology gets hot, they get the top developers in that space into their network so that any company that needs to hire developers who are amazing at this new technology can come to TopTal and count on having the best. One of the examples they gave me was they said when crypto got big, they went after all the top crypto people, got them in their network. And when businesses needed to hire cryptocurrency experts, developers who are the best in the space, there's basically just one place to go, TopTal. Mm-hmm. And you're one of the companies that went to them, right? You hired from TopTal?
We did hire from TopTal, not for a blockchain engineer, but we did. They basically focus on the top of talent, right? Sometimes very hard to find free that are great. We do have a relatively distributed team, at least for our engineering. And so our lead QA developer, we found on TopTal. So
why TopTal versus any other place? You could have put ads up online. You could have gone to all these different freelancing sites. Why TopTal?
And honestly, we do that. I think TopTal, sometimes like we really needed QA at the time. And I think sometimes by doing your own interviews, that process takes a little bit longer, right?
Yeah.
TopTal, we had a good list of people to choose from, and we found a great fit. And they had were they ready to start like pretty much right away. But we didn't use other sites also because at the same, it goes back to just the interviewing component of it.
Yeah,
like tests that the engineers or the candidates need to go through to basically qualify for the TopTal network. So just kind of a higher standard, I suppose.
You know what? That's a benefit that I don't talk enough about. The speed to hire, the velocity to getting started is just amazing with TopTal because they spend so long pre-screening people in their network, researching them and understanding who they are, how they work, so that when you as an entrepreneur or someone listening to us as an entrepreneur or anyone who's hiring goes to TopTal, half the work, if not 80%, has already been done. All you have to do is talk to the matcher, tell them what you're looking for. They put you in front of one or two. How many people? They give you two people to consider?
Yeah. I'm not the one that was a hiring manager for that one, but I do know that we had multiple.
Yeah. And then you get on a video video conferencing service like this. You talk to them. If you like them, you can often get started right away. If you're out there listening to me and you need to hire amazing people at a fast clip, there's no better place to go than TopTal. If you go to this URL I'm about to give you, you'll get 80 hours of TopTal developer credit when you pay for your first 80 hours, in addition to a no-risk trial period of up to 2 weeks. Here it is. It's TopTal, so it's spelled TOPTAL.com/MIXERGY, TopTal.com/MIXERGY. You're a guy who's an entrepreneur from the beginning, and I'm going to go back and understand like how you got started in entrepreneurship. And then you mentioned earlier, so we were building this music app anyway, and I want to know why you were building an app like that and what other apps you were building, and then bring it back to the point of the story that we've covered. As a kid, were you born in Brazil or you spent some time early on in Brazil?
No, I was born in Brazil. I speak Portuguese, my first language.
Got it. And then you ended up somehow in Southern Indiana. And what did you import into the US as a kid? This was something. This was clever.
Yeah. It's actually what I imported out of the US. But I was, so basically, the story goes, I was about 15 years old. I had started venturing into entrepreneurship. I was always kind of like that kid that was sort of hustle. I didn't really know what the word entrepreneurship was at the time, you know, as many people like that are. And then basically worked at Polo Ralph Lauren at the time for like a week and noticed how hard it was to make money. Started selling these leather jackets using my employee discount at the time on eBay. And I made literally like $20,000 in a very, like in a few months, like 20-30K a few months.
Wait. Buying polo clothes from Brazil?
No. So I was now in Indiana working at a store that was a factory outlet, right?
Okay.
16-year-old kid. Started working there for a week, got my first paycheck, and then realized that the amount that they value was like, I was just like really upset about it. And I was actually about to quit. And then I remember this big tour bus of people that were visiting from Japan or China went to this store because, you know, it's a really big outlet mall. They spent like 40K in there and I was the guy that helped it. And I was like thinking, I'm like, man, I'm going to definitely get some free commission for this. And then I got like a $25 RV's gift card. And I was like, man, that's so terrible. And then I was like, man, I had 40% off. I was like, if I could just get them 20% off, I would have made a ton of money. And then that was like what clicked this idea around using my employee discount to see like what items go on eBay, right? And definitely not my employee, like, you know, allowed.
It goes against the rules, but did you sell first on eBay and then buy the product?
No. So what I did was, I knew a return policy and then basically then I just went around and like to date myself. I mean, that's the weirdest person I've ever said that to date myself. I had a palm tree at the time and I would like literally take photos of all these like little, the barcodes, cross-reference it. And I found this one item that was like ultra high margin. It was like this leather jacket is sold for $400 on eBay. I can get it for $130 with my employee discount. I bought three on a credit card. I kept the receipt. And I sold all three that night for like $300 each. And I was like, man, I just made like $500 after my cost. And so I just kept buying those things. And then I had everyone in the store buying them. And then I just basically kept the job to keep the discount. And my manager was actually cool with it, believe it or not, at the time because it was affecting the revenue of the store. But after a few months, the general manager found out about it. And then I heard that I was going to get fired. So then I just kind of quit. But at the time, I basically was able to collect $30,000, which then allowed me to use that money to start other components, like a much larger business. Especially for high school kids.
And what was the larger business?
Yeah, so essentially that's what turned into kind of this import and export thing. So being from Brazil, I always noticed the differences between pricing of things, right? So as an example, a MacBook might cost $2,000 here. That same MacBook in Brazil will cost $6,000.
Wow.
And that is due to the import taxes, the general cost of sending the thing there, and then the markup that happens. In the early 2000s, mid-2000s, it was even worse. There was a lag on a lot of things that would essentially launch in these various countries. And it wasn't just true in Brazil, it's true in a ton of countries. So that's what I started doing. I started importing goods out of the United States into countries like Brazil. Then I started doing it to the UK. I set up a warehouse there. And what's interesting about the UK, it was part of the European Union at the time. And you could essentially sell items in Italy it was similar to the US, but the import tax in Italy is actually much higher than it is in the UK. But you can get it shipped one day from there. Doing this in Australia, mocking phone.
Wait, what you're doing is you're bringing it into the UK where the import taxes are low and then driving it from there to Italy or shipping.
Yeah, shipping it from Italy.
And then now where taxes are higher, you're competing against people who are paying more. Wow, this is quite a business. And yeah. So how did you get around import taxes into Brazil?
So in Brazil, it was honestly, the way I first started it, it was not, definitely not what I was supposed to be.
Would you have friends get on planes and bring the stuff in?
Yes, actually. Yeah. Ground attendants, a lot of airline attendants. Yeah. And then you would just bring it there. And then the issue about Brazil that became like, that's where I got started because I understood that market.
Yeah.
But hard to scale because then I was like, I can't just keep paying airline attendants and like, this isn't how things do. So I actually then eventually pulled out of Brazil because it was just like too much work to get set up there. And yeah. So what we started doing was doing the UK thing and that's how UK started. And then I actually moved to Australia for a period of time to set it up there as well. And then what was interesting is also the phone thing. Like I would unlock, I would buy phones here in the US, that were like refurbished and, especially from networks like, Sprint and Verizon, because they run on CDMA numbers, which are, serial number based. But they would have GSM numbers that our GSM chips, the BlackBerry one. So I can unlock those devices and send them overseas. And then, so I would get them at ultra high, low discounts here. And then I could sell it there for roughly the same price. So I scaled this business to roughly doing about $2 million a year, while I was a freshman in college, sophomore in college.
Wowee.
And it provided, I ran that business for several years, and it provided.
What did you do with the money? With the profit?
I basically took that money, as a kid, you'd buy like a car and stuff, but then eventually I started other businesses. So now I'm in college. I got into, doing screen printing. I did that for all the colleges, all the fraternities at school. Then I eventually started an online company, media company catered to like the fraternity demographic. And that's actually where I got into like online music. Cause that's what we were doing. We were doing playlists for people, before Spotify, and about, a million people a month were coming to the site and listening to the playlist that I was curating for parties and studying and all this other stuff. And eventually to actually the company how I met my co-founder, which was a crazy story in itself.
By the way, let me pause here on the co-founder. When I said importing, I had no idea you were doing all this. I didn't know you were buying clothes and electronics and then sending it down to South America. I just heard when you were a kid, you would buy Playboy in Brazil where it was easier to get and bring it to the US and sell pages of it to kids.
That's when I was in elementary school. Yeah.
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 Yeah. I mean, how'd you end up getting so many Playboy magazines? Your parents were just okay with it?
No. When I got caught for that. So they were not cool with that. My mom is definitely was not cool with that. But I'm more passive on it. And, it was like one of those things where, again, like, you have rules in the United States and there's technically rules there, but like when I can go 12 to any newsstand, be 12 years old, as long as I had the money, no one would say anything.
Yeah.
And in the United States, like it wasn't like that. So, but eventually you do get caught. I remember this money from his parents and then I got in trouble with this whole thing. But
what I'm seeing though is a kid who just had this creative energy, the ability to see that things cost less in one place, more in another, the willingness to sell it where it's more expensive, the hustle to find flight attendants who are going to move things in, places to sell it internationally. That's who you were as a kid.
Yeah. Yeah.
Couldn't wait to be an adult to start a company.
Yeah. Yeah. That was, I gave up like playing sports and all that stuff to start my business. Yeah. That was like, cause that's what I loved. Yeah.
All right. You were starting to tell me how you found your co-founder. Where did you find your co-founder?
Fiverr.
For what? What were you looking to do?
I didn't like set out to go to Fiverr to find co-founder. What ended up happening is I'm leaving college now and I just moved to Chicago. And I remember thinking to myself, like, I was happy about the business I started, but I really wanted to start like a scalable business and not just like do, the import and export stuff or screen printing or whatever. And so there was a contest that Bloomberg was putting on with the Techstars TV show back in the day. And so I needed to put a video for the startup idea I had after I did on the startup weekend. And so I found this person on Fiverr to make me this like $15 video. And we entered it and then won the contest on the Bloomberg TV show where we featured on the season finale, which got me into a top 25 Techstars New York interview with like David Tisch. And I remember my whole life I've been fine at school and done, businesses and stuff. And I've never bombed an interview with someone as worse than I bombed that one because I was like just this unprepared, cocky 22-year-old kid. But didn't change the fact that I spent $15 on a video on Fiverr and some ingenuity to be on Bloomberg television on the season finale and won that. So I thought to myself, like, what else can I get for $5? Right. And then at the time that music website was something that I was like, I should make an app for this. Like people are starting to focus on apps. And so I was like, I wonder if I could find an iOS engineer. And so I basically looked it up and someone posted like, we'll make app for $5. And told him the idea, said what it was. And he's like, oh, if I can't make that for $5, but I'll make it for like $85. And then I was like, well, okay, sure, like whatever. And I'm trying to justify to myself how this is like, how someone is going to make an app for $85 and why. And I'm like, maybe he's from a country that's a crazy, like where that's a crazy exchange rate. And then, you know, we became kind of like Skype friends. And over time, like maybe 6 weeks later, he delivered this app and it wasn't the best thing I'd ever seen, but it worked. And,
what did the app do?
Well, initially it was supposed to be a music streaming app, but, it was too hard. So it actually was, a bunch of kind of like college memes related to the, topic of the fraternity music stuff. And then we preloaded like 10 of our top tracks, that we had gotten approval for in there. And then people can do those like little crossword puzzle things. You know what I'm talking about? That used to be on the Microsoft, like home browser where you're trying to like decipher the little puzzle, like the image is scrambled.
Oh, okay. So an image of a meme is scrambled. They're listening to music and that's what he created. Did you come up with the change or did he come up with it? Did he say, I think I can't make a streaming app, but I can do this instead?
I think that, you know, that's a great question. I think I told him the initial idea and he's like, that's too complex. I mean, because, and then basically we found something that was possible. Underlyingly, like what I found out was that it was a 16-year-old kid at the time, 17 actually, and he was not from some random place from the United Kingdom, and he was like sick of reading programming books and wanted to just work on a real project, but at the same time didn't trust his own ability or skills because he had just kind of started. His dad also happens to be like a world-class CTO, and so he was always like kind of like a person that was kind of like always exploring and was like, hey, I want to work on a project. So he posted on Fiverr and I was his first Fiverr gig. And, that's how we became friends. And
how much did you pay him and what ended up happening with this?
I paid him $85 as we agreed. And then, it ended up making probably like 10K over the years, you know, over like a year or something.
Just because you left it in the app store.
Because I left in the app store, had good ASL. There wasn't a ton of apps. We had good traffic. You know, it made a couple thousand, like literally off the bat. You know, it was, and then like just kind of like, I don't even know how long that was there, but I was like, that was a good return. And it wasn't amazing or anything, but it was fine. And so, but then I was like, listen, and then we just kept talking, and I was trying to think about other app ideas because I thought that was really cool. And I was like, yeah, I just graduated, and I'm looking to start this company maybe. And then the idea that we came up with was eventually to, build an app builder that would allow people to build apps without coding. Cause I thought that was a big issue.
Yep.
I faced that issue. And so he's like, oh, I also graduated. And I'm thinking, and this one I found out he was so young. And he's like, yeah, high school. And then I convinced him actually to take a gap year, and move to Chicago.
You convinced him to take a year off of school and move to work with you after high school.
Yeah. And his parents were cool with it, which was shocking to me. And we never met each other. Then he lived on my couch for on and off for like a year. And we kind of struggled through, that first like 9 months. And then
is this actually, Kieran, by the way,
this is Kieran. Yeah.
Kieran Panesar.
Yes.
He's the co-founder. He's the CTO of the company. Okay. So he lived on your couch. You guys had an idea to build a builder that would enable people to create apps. Kind of like if you're thinking about building a website, they're builders that will allow you to build websites quickly. Okay. And that's your vision.
Yeah. And so we, super naive, build this thing and like we were able to build something, but it just wasn't, we didn't have all the things like that we needed to basically make something that was like competitive or similar to like a Squarespace or Wix. And so, but we did build like this builder that allows for rapidly build apps. So what I started doing was actually building a ton of different apps on different niches. And then we started making like 30K a month off that. But again,
30K.
Yeah, 20 to 30K a month every month on like these random niche content based apps, like paleo juice diets, like little baby music, whatever it was like different niches.
So if I was looking for paleo diet in the app store to see what came up, your app might come up. Basically, you were saying, what are people interested in? Let's create an app for that. And then where would you get the content for it?
We would just source it from all over different like content streams. And we were getting paid to curate content, right, for people, right?
And it was just a stream of content, almost like an RSS feed that you guys got.
Yeah, essentially. And it wasn't just RSS, but it also had like music and podcasts and because we had a bunch of integrations that we worked with. But anyways, it wasn't, again, I caught myself in the same problem, which was this isn't scalable. Fine, we're making some money, so it's not a full loss because I funded the whole thing, right? So it's like, damn it, like it's a lot of money for me just to fund. And then Kieran had to go back to college and because he was like, you know, I can't take another gap year. And then we basically took a step back and we're like, well, let's take a minute to rethink what we're doing. And so we came up with this idea to work on a different project that we just was actually supposed to be on a break. The general idea was to build an Instagram app, because Instagram was getting popular, that basically was like an exchange system that allowed people to get to the discover page. And so how it worked is you uploaded your photo and then people could like it or follow you. And if they did, they would get coins for doing so. One for liking, two for following. They didn't want to deal with all that nonsense. And they could just buy coins. And we built this thing in like a week. And this was what's really crazy. And it was a pivotal moment to our business or to whatever we were doing at the time. It wasn't really a full-blown like business per se at the time. We essentially launched it in the App Store. It went to the top three in the in the paid category, some of our top 11. And then, but more interesting and most importantly, it went to the top 77 in the grossing charts, which we were up there with like eHarmony, Wall Street Journal, and it was crazy because I remember launching it on a Friday and then I woke up the next morning and I was like, $581, like it only live for like 2 hours, like that must be an error. And then the next day, when I get my little report, like post Apple Cut, made 11K. And I was like,
whoa. Yeah. And it's because people were willing to pay for an Instagram app that let them what? Earn coins? Is that the part that was exciting?
Yeah, to get more likes and followers. It's called InstaLiker. And it allowed them to get more likes and followers and hit the discovery page.
On Instagram.
Yeah.
And, we were and wait, wait, how would you get the more likes on Instagram?
Because it was an exchange system. So people downloading the app and then each one liking and following each other. And then
got it. For every time I like someone else's, I get someone else to like mine. Got it.
Yeah, people just started buying them. And what ended up happening is we ended up scaling that to like 3 million users in like a couple months. Like it was organic, no money spent. It was insane. And we had made, I don't know, a few hundred thousand dollars. Like we were making like 10K profit a day or 2 months. Wow. And so eventually Kieran's like in his freshman week, you know, and he's like, well, cause like the issue with in the United States is that we had visa issues. Like the only visa he would qualify for was O1A visa, which is people of extraordinary ability. It's like the Nobel Peace Prize type visas, you know? And so he couldn't get the H-1B. So basically he's like, we talked to a lawyer and he's like, the only way for him to get one is if like we were able to raise some venture funding and get a letter of recommendation, all this other stuff. So it kept going on, kept making money. And then eventually we got this investor that was like interested in putting in, more than seven figures into our business. And then he did. And then, eventually we got Mark Cuban to be an advisor to the company.
Wait, who's the investor? You know, let's take a moment here. I'm going to come back and I'm going to ask you who the investor was and how you got Mark Cuban, because that was a big credibility point when I looked at your site. But first, let me tell everyone about my second sponsor. And all right, Mark Cuban, make sure that I come back to this. Second sponsor is a company called HostGator. Let me ask you this. You're a creative person. Imagine you're starting from scratch. Let's say you're 16 years old today and you have nothing but a hosting package from HostGator. You can host anything. It could be a WordPress site. It could be some other site. What would you do? Nothing else except for that. What would you launch?
I'd have a hosting site.
Yeah. What business would you launch if you could do nothing but have a website? Ooh.
Man, that's a good question. I probably would focus on TikTok. I would focus on people are trying to figure out what the hell is going on with TikTok because it's I've seen a lot of really smart, creative 17-year-old kids that are in like the marketing circles that I'm in, basically be the Gen Z expert for things like TikTok or Yo or not Yo, Yellow or whatever, like this other Snapchat app. And these apps that are kind of coming out that are focused on Gen Z.
Would it be an agency, like a website for where you can hire people who know what to do on TikTok to advise a company?
I probably would make it two things. It would be like an agency so I could have the service side business, but I probably like a lot of TikTok influencers and Thriller and these new platforms that are kind of coming out. There's some big people in there, big influencers, other kids that are like 15, 16, 17 years old, as in gaming too. And I probably just hit up all these kids and create kind of like my Rolodex of influencers, and then basically match the like being the expert, and I can get you into that because I know there's a ton of brands that are interested in that.
So if a brand, especially what? Sorry,
especially in the gaming category, the gaming category is like crushing it right now. I think it's going to be bigger than Major League Baseball.
What do you mean? What are they doing in the gaming category on TikTok?
And not just TikTok, but I'm saying in general, like gaming, like I would focus on kind of these new Gen Z related media categories. So like whether it's these like kind of like Gen Z apps, or like things like gaming related, what's kind of happening with like professional gaming, Fortnite, like these type of apps. Like these kids are some of them.
So what you're saying is you'd create the website would just be a place to house your agency where you would be a matchmaker between brands like maybe Snickers and TikTok influencers or people who have active accounts there. That would be the first thing that you started off with. And you just ping a bunch of the people who have big followings and who are creative and say, can I rep you? If I bring you Snickers, would you sign up?
Yeah, you can do that for them and like the gaming kids. I love
that idea. All right, listen to me. If you guys are out there and you have a website idea and you haven't started it, just go out there and create an account on HostGator. And one of the beauties of having an account on HostGator is you've got a place to play. And when you have a place to play, you just start creating. And this could be an idea that you run with. And once you put up a website with a simple template, fill in the blanks with a couple of pieces of information, it gives you so much more credibility when you reach out to people and say, here's the agency I'm running. Do you want to work with me? So again, whether it's that idea or any other idea that you have, including one that you currently are running and you don't like the hosting package on it, take your ideas, take your businesses over to HostGator. They will host you quickly. They'll host you dependably and they will scale with you. They've got everything from the cheapest website options all the way up to managed WordPress hosting that will just blow your mind. Go to HostGator.com/Mixergy to get the lowest price that they have available and to say that you come from us, which means that we will always back you. HostGator.com/Mixergy. All right, we were talking about investor. How'd you get the investor?
The way we got them, we actually got approached by one of the people that were working at the office and was like, hey, we saw like your profile, be interested in chatting with you. And then I actually sent them that, like, I don't know if you'd be interested in raising money right now, because as it stands, we make about $300,000 profit a month and our costs are like, $10K.
This is from the Instagram app?
Yeah. Yeah.
$300,000 profit?
Yeah.
Dude, do you still have money in your bank from all those import export businesses from this? Do you have over $1 million in the bank?
So we reinvested a lot of the money that we earned in back into the business.
Wow. Do you have more than $500,000 in the bank in liquid assets?
Yeah, in the vicinity, I think.
Okay. Wow. All right. So you're not going to be destroyed if this thing doesn't work out.
Yeah, I think it's, I mean, you pour like what you believe. Like at the end of the day, like I've always had the skill set to be able to create money for myself. I think what I'm trying to prove out now, and I talked about this in a different podcast, which was I was sick of like kind of like the businesses that are like, making 10K, 30K, 50K a month. Like those things are great, but that isn't like actually what I personally am trying to accomplish right now.
Those are side hustles or hustles that you had up until now. They were damn good. But it's just that once you stop hustling, it doesn't work. What you seem to want is a brand. You want the reputation. You want the thing that grows bigger than you. You want something really big and reputable. Am I sensing this right?
Yeah, I think it also has impact, and does something that's valuable for people. I could always go back to those things. Like one thing I'm never worried about is like, unless I have like a serious, concussion, lose my brain power, it's like, I will always be able to make an income for myself.
Why? What is it about you that allows you to always make an income for yourself?
I don't know. I think the creative thinking.
Because you have these creative ideas?
I think it's creative ideas, but I don't know. I've always been able to approach things a little bit differently than maybe the average person. And in business, I think it's the edge that you have that others may not. And basically a lot of people just kind of sit and dwell and think about it. Yeah. And I know that I'm a quick start personality. And, sometimes that is something I need to hold back, because you do make a lot of errors when you are a quick start sometimes, because you, especially when you have a lot like resources.
Let me go back to the basics. When you realize that in Brazil, computer equipment, it was more expensive than in the US. Most people would have thought, that makes sense. Wouldn't it be great if I just bought a laptop in the US and took it to Brazil? I could probably pay for my flight that way. You did it differently. How did you do that? Give me like an example from back then that shows how you move fast.
I just listed it as if I had it. And then I knew that if I had to get it there, the worst case scenario of how I could get it there, and also the best case scenario. And that's what happened. Like,
where'd you list it?
On the site called Mercado Libre, which is the which is the eBay of Brazil.
So you just went to Mercado Libre. You said, "Here's what? What did you say you have? A Dell computer?"
No. I only dealt with Apple because that was the high end. You have to know who your audience is, you know.
Okay, so you just listed an Apple computer. Somebody bought it. Did they pay you?
Yeah.
Okay. So once they paid you, you then had to find a way to get it to Brazil.
Yeah. So basically, I knew that I had a deal with actually a distributor of Apple products, and even if he didn't have it in stock, I was like, well, I can go to Best Buy. It's definitely in stock there. Worst comes to worst, I'll just return it. Like, you know, and that's that. And then so I need it right away. So I just basically started doing drop shipping right before kind of the whole Shopify drop shipping.
And then, but how'd you get it into the country then?
So I basically did the math, and even if I paid the import tax at 60%, I would break even. With shipping. And at the time I knew of someone that was traveling back to Brazil, a family member. And so I was like, worst case scenario, I can just give it to my grandmother and she'll just take it.
These are the worst case scenarios. What ended up happening?
I ended up giving it to my grandmother.
Got it. And then she put it in the mail when she got there.
And then, but eventually, I got connected to, some airline attendants and stuff through someone, because one of the guys that I ended up selling it to was also a reseller of products. And I don't know who he was reselling it to. But then I ended up finding this guy that would just buy like 10 at a time for me. And then he had, a bunch of airline attendants that I would just work with and send it to them. And then that's how it started in Brazil. The much bigger opportunity, and I'm going to say it's probably like 80% of the revenue, it started to be and became actually more of a real business, is I was wholesaling these goods to someone. And he came up to me, he's like, look, you're making a markup on me. But if you sell to me at basically your cost, I have a DVD business in the UK and we export all over the Europe. And if you look at the pricing, and at the time the pound was really strong, it was like, you know, 1.8 to 1, these things have worldwide warranty and I will let you export it to my warehouse and then we both sell it in there. And then I was like, okay, let's try that. And I was like, because I had always been doing wholesale or like these one-offs, and then I started doing individualized and it really scaled. And then I started making a lot more money.
Okay. I get now how you work. The investor came to you, said, I want to invest. You said, I have $300,000 in profit a month. Why would I do it? Why'd you end up saying yes?
The visa issue.
Just because of the visa. How much money did you take in?
We took $1.5 million.
Okay. Who was the investor? I don't think I've been able to find the person's name.
It was called Garland Capital. It was a family office here in Chicago.
Okay. All right. And so you got the money. And yeah. Then we were talking about how you ended up with crypto, partially because this friend of yours did a really big deal, partially because you were looking to grow, right? And then the SEC issue happened. Why didn't you give up on it at that point? Why didn't you say, you know what, this is starting to get too complicated. This whole crypto thing is a pain in the butt. Let's go find the next thing.
Yeah. So, and just to step back here. So these are happening different times, right? Because Karen, so then we eventually got him. And then we kind of ran that business and with that. And sorry, so your other question.
Thanks for clarifying it. So then you get the investor, you're continuing with the business. Now Kieran is allowed to stay in the country. You're going on, you have this idea for one of your apps, which was already in the works, right? The music app?
Yeah. So then actually with that $1.5 million, we actually decided to continue on with the app builder idea. And focus on that. And then this actually was a big learning for us because while that was happening, we still had these other apps that were actually pulling in the real revenue for our business, which was, you know, these Instagram apps or Facebook or whatever. Unfortunately, like those things are also kind of like you're using the API of a different service. And when they want to pull the access of your API, this is one of the, I've learned major lessons in my life around like depending your business too much on the App Store or Facebook or whatever. And I've constantly gotten screwed each time, you know, eBay, whatever it might be, like add the platform, I've probably been kicked off of it or had some sort of issue. And so that's where I'm actually really trying to get away from, which is where we're taking Current. But in any case, we built the App Builder platform, ultimately built a really nice service, but then ultimately shut it down because it didn't work. We focused one. I'm much more of a consumer entrepreneur than more of an enterprise consumer or enterprise entrepreneur, and so I built a consumer based app builder. But the issue that is different from say a Squarespace and a Wix is that they can just throw any website live, and they don't have to go through an Apple review process. They don't have to pay $99 for a Apple developer account. And then Apple started getting more and more apps, And then so the app review process got harder and harder and harder and harder. And eventually they're like, oh, this app is just like every other app. And then so all the app builder services that were just templatized app building, they pretty much all went under or they became agencies. And we basically made decisions like, you know, let's call it. You know, we have we still have funds. And we basically pivoted the idea to something else. Which was ultimately became Current. You know, we called it something else at the time, where we looked at the apps that we did make, and the apps that were actually the most successful and that people were interested in were the ones related to media, because we had this really cool music integrations and video integrations and all that stuff. And then we started running into this issue with the App Store, which was like, hey, there's too many apps in the App Store. So it's like, well, what if we created an app that basically aggregated all these different streaming services into one place? Because all of these, and you also have, you have these like little micro experiences, app-like experiences within one product. So we built that, and that's what we, you know, ultimately started building. And then we ran into a different issue. Goes back to, like, if I hadn't learned this in the first time, I learned it a second time, which is when you're building on top of another person's API, there's multitude of issues that occur. One, you're dependent on them. So if there's rate limiting, if there's a bug, if they don't want to cut off your service, that's an issue. And the second one is these companies spend hundreds of millions of dollars to create a superior user experience. And then so if you try and build that experience, it's very difficult, especially on a startup budget, right? And so we then had to pivot again. And we saw what are users doing in our product, right? And what we realized is the people that were using the product the most were free users. And they were using our free music services the most. And so when we did the radio integration, and that's essentially when we decided to focus just on music and give people a really great free music experience. And then the idea kind of went through as we kind of went through, which is rewarding for data and attention, and how do we increase that? And that's kind of like how that whole thing went through, but it's several different pivots along the way, because that's, you know, that's essentially what you have to do until you kind of find something that sticks within the market.
It feels like a lot of it did not depend on crypto. It just happened that you got into cryptocurrency. It happened that you got into blockchain. Am I right?
The initial idea wasn't just, it really came about, like, I think, you know, as a company, you have to always, or as an entrepreneur, you're always kind of looking at like, what are the trends, what's happening, whatever. Like, you know, 2015, I didn't hear anything about like data privacy, GDPR. We didn't hear about these things, right? And so that's happening. And then simultaneously, this concept of like this coin is like an attention token, right? Focus on this, and it's like basic attention token launched Brave, which is actually like building an awesome product, that is a crypto company that you should totally check out. It's like by the same guy that created Firefox, it's something that we started seeing that more as a trend. We're like, wow, this is a really big opportunity. And who are the users that are really going to be fanatical about this? And it's either really tech based people, which they tend to have more money, so that was not really their odds. But I was like, free users care about this stuff, and we'll focus on that, and that's our target market. So it was kind of a culmination of all those things, and also having the appropriate mentorship from people that have done it before to kind of like rethink the idea. Does this make sense? Can we do this? And that's ultimately how we got in it.
What about this? That I've seen lots of companies try to reward people for doing things online. And what happens is the people who want to be rewarded for doing things online aren't very valuable. There's not that much money in targeting them, and they need a lot more in order to entice them to come in. And so what you end up doing is going down this rabbit hole of how much can we take advantage of them and their willingness to do stuff for money. I see your eyes light up. So I know that this is making you uncomfortable. I get it. I'm not talking about you. I'm just saying in general, this is what's happened. You end up with them filling out forms for credit cards, which I know you can't do because it's incentivized, filling out stuff that you're basically cramming down to them, or you're taking affiliate products. Like if Netflix is super desperate to get new customers, which I think at one point they were, and they were willing to give out free trials and all that. You go to them and you say, I'll sign up for your affiliate program. You dump a bunch of users in their lap. They take that to the stock market and they say, look, we got a whole bunch of users. Meanwhile, everybody knows those users are never staying around and paying. They just basically paid a third party to incentivize people who don't have much money to go and sign up for Netflix because they were going to get points. I'm over talking about this, but you know the problem, right? I'm explaining this.
I think there's here's what I'll say. Everything has a conversion rate, right? And while there's a reason why these things work. It's not like these marketers are just spending money, idiotically. These people kind of like look into that. You'd actually be very surprised though about the brands that go after that type of audience. And one of the reasons though that like I didn't want to just be a rewards app and where we're kind of taking the business is to be much more in that, because that's basically what we're building. Then I would be very sad, I suppose. The general idea is like, let's provide something of value. And these people aren't paying monthly subscriptions for music like that. That I know about my user base. So they're going to use Pandora. They're going to use TuneIn. They're going to use free Spotify. And I was like, am I able to offer a comparable service? And that gives them maybe a feature that they don't have, like offline content, and pay them for it. Right. So that they know that their attention and data is valued at something. And that was why we kept the music and the streaming content in there. But to go a little bit further, I think that if you're not providing additive service to people outside of just like small micropayments, you're not going to have a great business. And so where we're kind of actually looking to take our business and actually in line with kind of building a moat around our company. So as I've mentioned many times, the one thing that every entrepreneur has to think about is like, how can I get shut down, or how, like, what would be detrimental to my business? And I was watching a YouTube video that talked about Spotify specifically, and Spotify, if they will ever be, they don't have to really worry about being shut down, but Spotify has a ton of dependencies on the business with the music labels. The fact that they, they're trying to go direct with artists, and will it ever be a $1 trillion company, right? The fifth horseman or whatever. And so what it talked about is like Spotify is a really tough time, because if you search music in the app stores, it's actually the fourth or fifth result, believe it or not, largest music service ever. And there's a big antitrust lawsuit happening right now because of that. And they're very dependent on these distribution mechanisms. And it talks about, until you have your own hardware and you can own the experience of the user, it's difficult to get out of just being like a software app. And software apps have retention issues and all that stuff. So what we're specifically looking at current is like, how can we take our model that pays users, call it $5, $10, $15 a month, and provide them something of value? And what does this user base really care about? And Current is an international product. So we look at not only like income and low middle class here in the United States, but we look at emerging markets of like, where are the people coming and where is this next 2 billion users coming online? And we acquire in countries like Philippines, Nigeria, Malaysia, and so on. And basically we're creating a model where we can provide a device, like a low cost Android device that would be the cheapest in the market that pays you as you use it. And the reason
that's what you want to create.
That is what we're working on. Yes.
So now you have no platform issues like you did. I don't know what happened with eBay. We didn't get into it, but I understand. With Instagram, I imagine they just cut it out because they did not want you to trade on likes, right? So now you thinking is, if we create a free Android device, that then
pays you for your attention. So basically,
free and pays you for attention.
Yeah. So eventually, we want it like in the US, I actually think that we can offer it for free because we have a unique business model with it, where it's like pay with attention, right? You do this little action, you get this phone. And then essentially, as you use this phone, your data and attention would pay for your data and voice plan.
Got it. How much money do you guys have in the bank in order to be able to do all this?
I mean, we have over eight figures in the bank.
Okay. And one of the reasons why you could do it now is Android phone prices are coming down dramatically.
So here's the thing.
Yeah.
It's a really unique, like, look, it's not, people have tried this before in the past. And like, if you actually look at, there's articles for like the $4 smartphone in India, let someone try to launch, and actually it was a huge bomb. It's Moore's law, right? The chips get cheaper every year. There's a ton of like stuff going on, and we can basically manufacture really high end devices, and for very low costs, and like, you know, call it $50, and $60, and sell a device, for, you know, and just be the cheapest 4G device that exists. But where we're really, monetizing is the usage after. And a lot of, and the thing that's really interesting about it is that if you tried to do this 5 years ago, 7 years ago, and like, some businesses have already kind of like tried to do it, like in other things. So Amazon launched the sponsored Kindle Fire, right? And they remember it was like cheaper. And so, but a lot of things that have been difficult is that like 5 years ago, the mobile advertising industry is not what it is. And then today, like the average user is using their phone 4 to 5 hours a day. So we can monetize all these different experiences that are occurring in the product, and that's what our software does. And as people are using that, we're providing value back to them. And then also the retention mechanism over the course of the next 12 months is much more valuable, because a person owns a phone for a year, right? 6 to 12 months. A person may have an app. If an app has a 30-day 30% retention rate and it's a consumer app, that's a sick number. That'd be great, right? And but most companies don't. So
What do you guys have? I get the vision for the future. Today, what's the churn on the app, or how many times, what's your average user? What's your average usage?
Yeah, today we do over 100 million impressions, ad impressions a month through the product.
But are the people who download it, how often are they using it?
So our rolling retention is about, I think, 30 or 40%. That's rolling retention. So like new user retention is probably in the vicinity of like 10% at like day 30 or week four. Okay. And again, that goes back to kind of figuring out, and it changes depending on the country. Like we'll see some countries are much higher, other countries are much lower. And what we try and do is like, and it goes back to the international thing of like what we learned, right? Which was, you'll find some really weird markets. Like you'll see like Singapore has higher CPMs than the United States, right? And you'll see these like weird kind of like things happening. So we analyze the data and what are the best countries for us to go acquire users in. And so we're still early as a company, but it has been scaling. I mean, if you look in the App Store, we have, you know, well over, you know, 500,000 downloads just on Android and over 50,000 reviews. But, you know, we've had millions of users download Current thus far.
All right. For anyone who wants to go check it out, you guys have a really well-designed page. It's current.us, right?
Yeah, current.us.
Whoever designed it, a lot of props. The images, the simplicity, the clarity, it's just really a well-done page. And it's not just that page. I went into the careers page. I clicked around to other pages. The design is really nice on it. It's current.us for anyone who wants to go check it out. And from there, of course, you can go into the App Store and install it, or just look at the business. I want to thank the two sponsors who made this interview happen. The first is HostGator. If you're hosting a website, go to hostgator.com/Mixergy. And the second, if you're hiring developers, do what I've done, do what so many people who I've interviewed have done, go to toptal.com/Mixergy. All right, now that it's over, how's it feel? Was I a dick?
No. You were good, dude.
Right? I didn't come at this with like happy-go-lucky, but I was absolutely curious. And man, you won me over with some of those stories. And the big vision. I get it. I think that it's gonna be a challenge to get there, but I love the big vision for where you're going.
Yeah, for sure, man. Yeah, nothing's easy in life. You know, you gotta go for it. So right. I did have a question for you, actually. I remember the schedule. You did a marathon in Antarctica, huh?
Yeah.
How was that?
It was amazing to be in Antarctica. I'm not really somebody who's just into beauty and surroundings, but the fact that I got to run through that beauty and then look at the surroundings, I got really lit up about it. And I just kept going. And the truth is that I ran a marathon before then in Chile because I wanted to do a South American solo marathon. And then a week later I was in Antarctica and I ran a marathon there. And then I was on all these flights and I didn't give my body a chance to recover. And right now I'm feeling it in my back. I'm feeling it in all over. So, do I what?
Do a lot of marathons?
I did a lot last year. I ended up doing 8. One of them, the one in Santiago, Chile, was a formal marathon. And as I was waiting for the flight to Antarctica to be cleared for safety, I was going nuts. And so I said, that's the only continent that I didn't do a solo marathon on. Everywhere else was a solo marathon, just me doing 26.2 miles, me and my camera. And so I said, screw it, I'm going to do it. So in Chile, as I was waiting for the flight to Antarctica, I went and I did 26.2 miles, and it was fantastic.
That's cool, man. I'm doing my first half marathon in May, and I've been listening to just here in Chicago. Kieran's a huge runner. He runs like marathons and stuff, but I'm like a larger guy, but I've been doing it now, and I've been reading this book by David Goggins. Have you ever...
is it?
He does ultra... This guy's a Navy SEAL guy. I keep forgetting the title, but...
You know what? I just bought it because this guy on Antarctica can't hurt me. I was on Antarctica. Freaking guy says, this is the book that gets me going. And he was skiing.
I listen to that book while I'm reading. While I'm running.
While you're running.
And I listen to an audible because this guy, man, he's unlocked his mind, man. He's one of the most intense guys. And he's like, he went through the story, just really insane. And then he does all these extra marathons. He went and did an ultra for 100 miles, 24 hours with no training. But he's like, he's literally just like, while I read that thing and I'm just like, what the fuck am I bitching about? It's like,
I still have not heard this book, even though I got it I was planning on just listening to it on Antarctica. I thought we'd be stuck there with bad weather. It turns out I got back faster. It's let me tell people, it's Can't Hurt Me by David Goggins. I think it's actually published by Tucker Max's publishing company.
Ooh. Yeah.
I think that's Lioncrest.
Yeah, it's been great. I highly recommend it. I've been listening to it for the last week and every time I work out.
All right, good luck in the marathon.
Yeah, thanks, brother.
Half marathon, but thanks for being on here. Thanks for doing this interview.
Bye. Sure.
Bye, everyone.